I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Unbeknownst to everybody, I was actually the guy out there. I was in overalls and a hat, so I wasn't. But I actually was the guy working the cones out there. You really are not serious with that question.
That was New Jersey Governor Chris Christie insulting our guest, Matt Katz, who was asking the governor about what has come to be called the Bridgegate scandal. More on that later. Matt has been covering Christie since 2011, first for the Philadelphia Inquirer and now for the public radio station WNYC and for New Jersey Public Radio. He starts his new book, American Governor Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption, with that exchange, and then traces Christie's family life and political career to the present. One person Matt interviewed said Christie wanted to be in politics ever since he was a baby. Christie is known for his combative personality, something he's been selling on the presidential campaign trail. And while he gets a lot of attention from the media, he can't seem to get out of single digits in places like New Hampshire. Matt Katz joins us on Radio Times to talk about his book, to talk about Chris Christie. And Matt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on the book as well.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You have spent 5 years tracking Governor Chris Christie. Do you like him?
Yes. I can't imagine that I could have followed somebody this long, thought about a single person who I'm not related to this long, spent so much time analyzing somebody this long without being fascinated by him and connected to that, liking him. I find him enjoyable personally to be around. And there are certainly times where I'm, you know, listening to a third and fourth hour of tape of him in a single day, which I did many nights while researching and writing this book, where I'm absolutely sick and tired of Chris Christie. And there are times at night when, like, my son will wake up crying and I kind of startled out of sleep, and I'll realize I'll have been dreaming about Chris Christie.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's a little overwhelming. but having said that, I do like him.
He has such an interesting relationship with the press. On the one hand, you've got, you know, Morning Joe that seems to have a love affair with Chris Christie. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how he feels about you. I'd be curious what you think Chris Christie thinks about you, Matt Katz. But also he has used the media in such an effective, it seems, and focused kind of way, a whole sort of team of people that he has been sending out for years now to cover his events, to make sure the lighting makes him look good. Such an interesting focus on the media from Chris Christie himself.
It's extremely sophisticated, and the media in general is the reason behind his success. I mean, he has been driven to national fame by virtue of his personality. That is the asset that he sells, even running for president. So there's sort of three parts of this. There's the relationship with the local press, and that is the most antagonistic, and that's his biggest problem in general, even now running for president, when people go back and look at what the local press has written about him over the last several years and covered, and how they've covered him over the last several years. And it's been antagonistic. And if, you know, usually professional, but also antagonistic. I mean, he has scolded myself and my colleagues many times in press conferences. He has given us less and less access the more and more famous he's gotten. The more and more prominent he's gotten, the closer and closer he's gotten to running for president. And I think we've done really fair and tremendous journalism, despite the fact that the Statehouse press corps, like statehouses across the country, is far more depleted than it ever has been. There have been great reporting from the local papers on Sandy recovery, watchdogging all kinds of aspects of the administration. But that's totally different from the treatment he's gotten, for the most part, from the national press. Particularly Morning Joe, which I write about.
They seem to love him.
They absolutely adore him.
There's, and vice versa, right?
For sure. For sure. It's been a way for him to get away from the New Jersey press corps. There's no major media market in New Jersey, as you know. So it's, you know, split between Philly and New York. It gets second shrift. And he can reach New Jerseyans, and he has reached New Jerseyans, by jumping over New Jersey media and going right to the national guys. He has gotten, some tough reporting, certainly from like the New York Times, but he's also had several covers on the New York Times Magazine. He was on the cover of Time Magazine twice in a single year. He's done Fallon and Letterman. He's been on E. He's used all these different national outlets, and the third piece of it is how he's created his own media outlet, and that's using YouTube videos and town hall meetings where a video team has come to film him performing in front of audiences and taking questions and sometimes yelling at constituents, sometimes, you know, telling personal stories that makes people tear up with emotion. And all those are cut up and all those are sent to these cable national outlets that then, you know, put them on the air because of it.
In fact, something like 2,500 people were the recipient. I mean, this is something you had to go to court to get some information about. It's like, who was getting all this stuff from Chris Christie?
Yeah, that's right. I was at the Inquirer in 2010, and we were looking at another reporter was actually covering Christie at the time, and we were talking about, you know, how all these national media outlets were getting, like, you know, snippets of Christie's quotes at town hall meetings. It was amazing. He'd only been governor for a few months. And a reporter by the name of Cindy Burton actually put in the first request to try to figure out who was getting his press releases and his YouTube videos, the links from the taxpayer-funded media office, and they denied her request. I came in to the beat. I requested several times. I appealed to a government records council, which is controlled by Christie, and this is a unit that can take your appeals if you request a document from the government and they don't give it to you. They denied me in a secret bizarre meeting. And all I was looking for, to be clear, was who is on the governor's press email list. What reporters are getting his press releases, essentially.
Pretty basic information,
absolutely,
right? Not a smoking gun necessarily.
For sure. No. And clearly public information. These are names and email addresses compiled by taxpayer-funded staffers during government time. It took until I got to WNYC and pro bono lawyers sued for a whole slew of public documents we were looking for, including this. And we eventually won and were able to view the list. And there were 2,500 names. And it was fascinating for how national the list was. There were about 88, I think, contacts for Fox News.
Wow.
There were Republican political operatives on there. There were people who worked for the governor in a political capacity. And this was how he was getting out his YouTube videos. And he became, as I write in the book, really the first YouTube governor. It's hard to overstate how important this relatively, you know, this newish medium, which particularly 5 years ago was pretty new. This newish medium was to building this sensation, because you had their mechanism for getting the information out there. Then you had the staging of these town hall meetings where so many of these YouTube clips emanated from. He had a guy with a stage management degree who was a lighting expert who was funded by taxpayers that made him look really good in these videos. They had a team of people that would come 5-6 hours in advance of the town hall meeting to set the place up. They had specific relationships with local Republican groups that they would contact to make sure they filled the audience. So it was a relatively friendly crowd. They experimented with different formats, ended up doing a theater in the round where, you know, the staging was really effective and looked really good on YouTube. And it totally worked for him. And it's a big reason why he's a presidential candidate now.
You said several things. One is this was taxpayer funded. So there's a question about whether he was using this to what campaign. They're not supposed to commingle that kind of money. But also the fact that it took going to court to get some of this information. He's a secretive governor, is he not? I mean, it's hard to get information out of him. I think you say in this book that only one email in his entire time as governor has ever been made public.
That's right. Despite the fact that he slams Hillary Clinton for her secret email server, the governor has never released any of his correspondence. There's only one email that's ever come out, and that was due to a subpoena related to Bridgegate. It has been very difficult to get information either through spokespeople or documents. There have been certain budgetary information that used to be on the state website that's since been removed. The biggest contractor for Sandy recovery, the contractor that was getting hundreds of millions of dollars to distribute aid to homeowners who suffered losses during Sandy, that contractor was secretly fired. No announcement was made. Not only was no announcement made, the cabinet member in charge of Sandy recovery was called to testify before the state legislature after the firing, and he was talking about that very program that the company was running, and he said everything was fine, didn't mention the fact that it was all in shambles because they just fired the contractor.
What's so interesting, because the book also goes into Chris Christie's past. When he was a college student at the University of Delaware, as you write, Matt, he opposed racism as a U.S. attorney. He had alliances with minority communities. As governor, as you say, certainly starting out with this big tent idea, he did nominate a Muslim to Superior Court. And when people, I think some conservatives or maybe Tea Party people, started criticizing him, he says the Sharia law business is crap. And more recently, he says that even if you're a child and a Muslim, he doesn't want you in New Jersey. Mm. Such a contrast between the sort of early young Chris Christie and the Christie that we see today.
Yeah, that was one of the most surprising things I found is until recently, a very consistent effort and seemingly authentic effort to reach out to minority communities. From the time he was, like you said, in college, he started a diversity committee as the student body president at the University of Delaware in 1984. I mean, a diversity committee in 1984 that had there was a gay student on there. There was a women's rights student on there. He went to the U.S. Attorney's office, and I was told by somebody he worked for, he was the U.S. Attorney of New Jersey, and he there was an MLK, a Martin Luther King Day luncheon that normally hardly anybody went to. It was a couple of staff members, and the new U.S. Attorney, Chris Christie, came downstairs and gave this very moving speech that apparently drew people to tears. He came into office and as governor, and he made appointments, minority appointments, including this Muslim judge, got a lot of criticism for it. And he stood up to the hard right of the Republican base. And he said, this is ridiculous to criticize it. He's not going to implement Muslim law. And he called them crazies.
Yeah.
Really extraordinary for a Republican to stand up to what would be seen as the more intolerant wing of his party in this day and age. But as you mentioned, since he's run for president, the tone has changed a little bit. He has likened the Black Lives Matter movement to cop killers. He says they inspire cop killers. His rhetoric against Black Lives Matter is actually more aggressive than any other Republican candidate. He says that, anybody from Syria, including three-year-old orphans, shouldn't be allowed in the country. So it's been a change.
We are talking about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie with Matt Katz. His brand new book is called American Governor Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. Much more after this very short break. And you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoen talking with Matt Katz about his new book, American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. Matt has been covering Chris Christie for about 5 years now, first for the Philadelphia Inquirer, now for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. Matt writes at the very end of the book, in fact, the last sentence of the book, is that Christie is the most interesting person in American politics to cover. And again, you can join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Let me skip up a couple of years to the devastation of Sandy. Chris Christie invites the president, President Obama, to come and view the damage that Sandy has done. This is, of course, right before the election. And it's been said that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie helped Obama win re-election. Do you think Obama helped Chris Christie win re-election in New Jersey because it is a blue state?
Yes, absolutely. It was an extraordinary and iconoclastic moment. This happened within a week before the election in 2012. Christie had been Mitt Romney's biggest surrogate, except for Paul Ryan, the running mate. He had been running around the country saying Barack Obama can't find the light switch of leadership in the Oval Office. And then all of a sudden, the most devastating storm in New Jersey history bears down, and Obama calls him that night. And they talk several times, and Obama says, anytime you need to talk to me, you call this number, and I will get back to you within 15 minutes, and I'll take care of, we'll take care of what you need. And it happened. I mean, he got fuel he needed, and then Obama asked if he could visit, and Christie said yes. And then Christie was asked on Fox News why Obama's visiting and whether Mitt Romney was also going to visit.
Right.
And he, Christie looked haggard and he looked tired and he looked angry. And he said, if you think at this moment that I give a damn about electoral politics, then you don't know me. And I think that people who may have not agreed with, Christie on charter schools, or they didn't think that Christie was always the nicest guy in the world, who didn't agree with him on abortion or, a range of other things, saw somebody who would put his duty and his leadership and his state before politics. Mm. And people thought that was extraordinary for this time, for this day and age. And that's such a major reason why he won with such dominant support in New Jersey for re-election.
But does it also explain why he can't seem to make traction as a presidential candidate? Because, the picture, the hug, the bromance, the photo op with Obama, that hurts him with some of these more hardcore Republicans.
It does. I think it hurts him more in a more conservative place like Iowa. And I don't think it's the fundamental reason why he's not doing that all that great in the presidential race. But it is certainly something that when I've visited some of these early states, it's something that they know about him and something that he's asked about. He has a great answer. I would do the same thing again.
Right.
We had 350,000 some odd people out of power. We had, the water treatment facilities were down and hospitals were blacked out. It was chaos. And the one man in the universe who could help the people of my state was the president of the United States. And I wasn't going to hang up the phone on him. And that convinces people. But it is something of a liability. I don't think it's the chief problem that he has. He's got plenty of others.
Mm. When do you think Chris Christie began running for president? I mean, there were certainly some noises a number of years ago. Mitt Romney, as you mentioned, was at least interested temporarily in having Chris Christie possibly be a running mate. I think they determined there was just too much baggage there. Mm-hmm. But how long do you think he's had presidential aspirations?
I think since he's been a child.
Really?
I think he
wanted to be president of the United States?
There are anecdotes of him telling the mother of a elementary school classmate that he wanted to be president. I mean, he ran for president of his class every year, like literally every year. He was the president of his class in middle school, every year of high school, president of the University of Delaware student body. I mean, he is somebody who owns that role in his mind and has certainly wanted to do this forever. He was asked first about running for president in his first year as governor, and he made his first trip to Iowa, the first caucus in the nation, a presidential caucus in the nation, in 2010, in his first year in office. I think he's made moves toward that, and not everything has been a calculation. You can't, perfectly game these things out, but I think he has been setting himself up for it from the beginning.
You have been tracking, or I think trying to track, how many days Chris Christie has been out of state, out of New Jersey, whether running for president. He was head of the Republican Governors Association. Have you been able to determine, for instance, last year, how many days out of 365 he was out of state?
I believe it was 272. with 270-something to maybe 271, and 190 of those days were not in the tri-state area, we're not in New York or Philadelphia. He spent a lot of time at dinners and raising money in New York and Philly. But other than that, and then he spent 190 days not in New Jersey, New York, or Philly. He doesn't really count New York or Philly as out of state because he can be home at night. But 190 days, most of last year, he was, a plane ride away at least. And that's part of the reason why his poll numbers in New Jersey have plummeted. He's at like 30-31%.
Oh, is that right? That low?
And it's because people feel he's been an absentee landlord. And Democrats in the legislature that used to work with him in all kinds of things will tell you that too. Republicans are starting to say that as well. There's been an absolute slowdown in the governance of New Jersey. The state of New Jersey is missing a Supreme Court justice. There's not even a nominee. I think a half a dozen of his cabinet members are operating in an acting capacity. They haven't been formally nominated and confirmed by the state Senate, including an attorney general that's been sitting there in an acting capacity for 2 years. There's no major initiatives. There's no major negotiations going on the state's biggest fiscal problems, dealing with public employee pensions and a transportation trust fund, which pays for a road and bridge and transit repairs. There's no negotiations going on with that. And that's because, it's a full-time job plus some to run for president of the United States.
I don't want to make too much of this, but it seems like there was this football game. I'm going to show my football ignorance here, but yeah. He was in Texas. You can fill in the blanks here. But do you think that was a sort of a turning point for Chris Christie, that somehow hanging out with the football moneyed people sort of spurred his ambitions?
It seemed to be. It's interesting. After Bridgegate, if we go back to when he won re-election, it's November 2013, and he won 51% of the Hispanic vote, for example. That was part of the reason, and then 61% of the total vote in a blue state. It was part of the reason why he became a front runner for the presidential nomination in 2016. He was beating every other Republican in the country at the time, and he was in some polls like almost beating Hillary Clinton to win the White House. And that's so now it's December 2013. January 2014 is Bridgegate breaks open. And after that, it seemed like his trajectory started to dip. But it wasn't until almost a year later when he was seen jumping up and down in Dallas with Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones.
Right.
And a bunch of other rich guys, and they had this awkward high five, and it was a very not something you would expect of a guy who's cultivated this everyman blue collar persona. Not only is he rooting for one of maybe America's most hated teams, but
certainly around here, right?
Certainly around here. And this it was part of a several weeks where Jerry Jones, the owner of Dallas Cowboys, was paying to send Christie all over the country to put on this kind of silly looking orange sweater as his, good luck charm at these Dallas Cowboys games. It prompted our current mayor, who was not a candidate at the time, to gently curse at him on Twitter. It prompted a tremendous amount of backlash. And his poll numbers took a more serious drop after that than they had even after Bridgegate. His name was trending all over the country. There are a lot of places that hate the Dallas Cowboys in this country. And there was something about how awkward and not cool that it was as somebody in Christie World told me, it was counter brand.
Ah, interesting.
And that's, here's a guy, his slogan is telling it like it is. He's supposed to be authentic. And there's something about that that rubbed people the wrong way. Not to mention the fact that Jerry Jones had a major contract with the Port Authority, which is a agency that is run by Chris Christie and the governor of New York at the time. So it was a government contractor situation too.
I do want to get to the Port Authority. And of course, Bridgegate is, well, just one other little thing that you – and I don't – he's certainly not the first politician who's liked to hobnob with celebrities. He's hung out with Bono, King Abdullah of Jordan, and Chris Christie seem to have a bit of a, bromance going. He seems to enjoy the high life, I guess, that comes with being a national political celebrity himself.
Yeah, he seems to like the perks. He got in trouble when he was U.S. attorney for spending too much money on hotel rooms. Mitt Romney apparently was upset because he wanted to, you know, fly in nicer jets when he was helping Mitt Romney run for president. He has, you know, partied with George Clooney at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and Jamie Foxx in the Hamptons. He loves going on Fallon. He likes to tweet at Fallon. He enjoys the fame and the perks and the celebrity that this American governor experience has given him. And sometimes it's been a bit of a preoccupation. I mean, the Jerry Jones thing,
yeah.
having a guy who, you know, some rich famous guy pay to send you around the country while you're supposed to be, you know, running for, you know, starting to run for president, A, and B, running the state of New Jersey, and this guy's got a major contract with a government agency, was ill-advised. But as he once said, he likes to squeeze all the juice out of the orange, and that's what he's done. And he also has told me that he wants to make it worthwhile for his family. I mean, his kids have enjoyed a pretty unique experience because of this, it comes with downside being in the spotlight, but
for sure.
You know, some of the hanging out with celebs and hanging out in the clubhouse at the Mets games is something that his kids have been able to enjoy out of this. So
that's Matt Katz, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. His book is called American Governor Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. And Matt has been covering Chris Christie for about 5 years now, first for the Philadelphia Inquirer, now for WNYC and for New Jersey Public Radio. And again, if you want to join our conversation, any questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I see some not very friendly comments about Chris Christie. Let's dig apart or pull apart the Bridgegate scandal, such as it is, Matt. And you spend, 120 pages kind of going through the moment by moment, almost day by day, person by person unfolding of this scandal. So what happens is there is a traffic jam at the George Washington Bridge to punish the mayor of Fort Lee, a guy named Mark Sokolich, for not supporting Chris Christie for reelection. I mean, if we boil it down to what this scandal is about, is that what it's about?
It's about political retaliation. Exactly right.
And why didn't Sokolich support Chris Christie? I mean, is there a reason that we know?
We know that Sokolich was a little upset that he was having a groundbreaking in Fort Lee one day, and Christie happened to be at a Dallas Cowboys game and never made it to the groundbreaking. But, you know, Sokolich is also a Democrat,
right.
And there are plenty of reasons why a Democrat wouldn't endorse a Republican governor. But Christie's people were trying to get as many Democratic endorsements as they could in 2013 because they wanted to win in a blue state, and they wanted to win big, so he could show that he could succeed amongst Democrats and therefore have a reason to be the Republican nominee for president. So this was all kind of connected to the larger game plan among his people.
Well, and just it's so easy to get lost in this story, but a guy named Bill Stepien ran the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, gave out his cell phone number to all the mayors in New Jersey. Was there a kind of a quid pro quo, I'm going to give you this so that you're going to support us? Was it as overt as that?
There was an office, this Intergovernmental Affairs office, in that was run by it was paid for by taxpayers. These were government workers, and they were overtly on government time, we know, asking about endorsements. They were, you know, they would go to a town and maybe deliver. They would outreach to local mayors. So they go to a town and say, you know, what do you need and how can we help you as on a government capacity? But then they would also bring up possible endorsements. Hey, so maybe you consider endorsing the governor, come the 2013 reelection. And then they would come back to the office and using government forms, it would say endorsement targets. And they would have a list of names and write, you know, what the political narrative was. Do you want to support this person? Is this person going to support the governor? Why? Where does he stand? And they'd also put other like bits of intelligence, like apparently there's a wayward Republican in this particular town that we should keep an eye on. And they would do certain things also to build relationships to like, for example, they had steel from Ground Zero. The Port Authority, an agency run in part by the governor of New Jersey, controls Ground Zero. And there was burnt steel from when the towers came down and that they would deliver as gifts so towns could create their own 9/11 memorials. And folks from the IGA would deliver this steel. They would also had American flags that had flown over Ground Zero, and folks from the IGA would help deliver these flags. And once they're delivering the flag, they say this is from the governor of New Jersey. It came with an official letter from the governor of New Jersey. And
tied to 9/11.
Tied to 9/11, and the mayors, local mayors would be thrilled to get this stuff. They could put it in town hall, and they were very honored to have a gift from the governor of New Jersey, and they got to tell their constituents that the governor bestowed this on me and us, and they'd be all very proud. And then this IGA person would also say, hey, by the way, you know, maybe they'd go for a walk around town. Maybe they'd, you know, sit in the mayor's office and say, you know, maybe consider next year. I know you're a Democrat, but maybe you consider next year endorsing the governor for re-election. So there's a sense here that not only were they doing political activities on government time, but some of these gifts, including 9/11 artifacts, were being used as something of a Trojan horse to cut in and do political work.
You include the code of conduct for employees of the office of the governor, H, campaign work, and employees shall not engage in campaign work on state time. Does that – what they did at the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, did they break the law?
Prosecutors do not think so, apparently. No charges have been filed. I guess charges could have been filed on the federal level, and they have not. Charges were not filed on the state level. Then again, the attorney general serves at the behest of Christie, so that was always unlikely. In the least, they were playing in a gray area. I think other politicians certainly do this. Politics and government intertwine. Government people talk politics. Some of these conversations are inevitable, right? I mean, you're talking about this is what you people have in common. You know, they both run for public office. They're both operating in the state of New Jersey. You're going to end up talking about elections, I guess. But, you know, some of the files that they kept in their office were so overtly of a political nature. They were had a list of towns that they favored most, and they were using – they had lit all these kinds of lists, and they were based on election data, that they would analyze election data and determine who their favorite towns were based on numbers and votes.
We will carry on our conversation after this very short break. That's Matt Katz, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. His new book is called American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. We are talking about Bridgegate, as it has come to be called. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Do stay with us. Much more. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. In fact, it's Ballot Talks on Radio Times, talking with Matt Katz about Chris Christie and Matt's new book called American Governor. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Again, going back to the Bridgegate scandal, Bridget Ann Kelly saying, time for some traffic problems at Fort Lee. And just as a reminder, Matt, we're talking about how many days of just complete gridlock? I mean, I think anyone that's crossed the George Washington Bridge, even under normal circumstances, will say it's a borderline nightmare in terms of traffic. So imagining, you know, the loss of some of those lanes, the kind of traffic jam that was created.
Sure. This is something of a misconception. Oh, it's just a day of traffic. First of all, it's the busiest bridge in the world. Second of all, it was 5 days, and these were the local lanes that were normally three lanes that they were cut down to two. And what resulted was mass traffic in this little town of Fort Lee, and then extending out to even other towns. And it was a public safety emergency.
Right?
Couldn't move. I mean, you had ambulance drivers trying to get to emergencies who were jumping out of their vehicles and running to the scene of an incident. There were school children. I mean, it was the first week of school. There were school children on their way. Imagine kindergartners. They've been thinking all summer about going to school, their first day of school. They're on the bus to kindergarten, and then they're on the bus for an hour, 2 hours. People had to go to the bathroom. People had to go to dialysis appointments. People had to take care of pets and elderly relatives. I mean, there were taxi drivers lost a week worth of wages. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of little inconveniences, and then dangerous moments. And I kind of went through 911 calls and laid out the fact that this was certainly a public safety emergency. And the mayor, and you see in these text messages he sent and phone calls he made to the governor's representatives at the Port Authority, he's like, I'm desperate here. I mean, please, why? And can someone help tell me what's going on? Why were these lanes closed? And he was just not getting any response.
In fact, some of those emails he's saying, is someone trying to punish me?
Yes.
Or some version of that?
Right, right. He actually brings up the possibility that this was retaliation for something. Mm-hmm. He's already suspect of it. One of the days of the lane closures, that's actually the anniversary of September 11th, and George Washington Bridge in the past has been a target of terrorism. So that was another major concern that was ignored by officials.
Have you been able to determine what Chris Christie knew and when did he know it? To spout a cliche, someone talks about, you know, this was coming from Trenton. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Also, David Wildstein is seen at a Ground Zero ceremony talking with Chris Christie. We see them. Do we know what they were talking about?
Yeah, that's the biggest.
And what does Wildstein say?
The Wildstein has pleaded guilty to this, and there'll be a trial that's now scheduled for May. And he says evidence, through his lawyer, has said that evidence exists, indicating that the governor may have known about this. Now, the governor obviously denies having anything to do with this before, during, or after. But we do have this one sort of enticing piece of evidence. It's a photograph of the two of them talking, Wildstein and Christie, while the lanes were closed, while people were stuck in traffic during a September 11th ceremony at Ground Zero. And, you know, Wildstein is checking his BlackBerry and they're kind of laughing. And who knows what they're talking about? Christie himself says he doesn't remember.
Mm-hmm. There's a question about who's an unindicted co-conspirator. Perhaps, I don't know if we know, you know, who's on that list, but is it possible that Chris Christie could be on that list?
Certainly possible, but again, we do not know. Where a bunch of media organizations have put a motion, have filed a letter with the court to try to get this document. The defendants, there are two defendants, Bill Baroni, who used to work at the Port Authority with Wildstein, and then Bridget Ann Kelly, whom you mentioned, former deputy chief of staff to Christie. They've asked that this list be released, which makes us think that it's somebody higher than them on the food chain is on here, and they're going to try to argue that they maybe were not the ones making this decision. They were just following orders. Again, the cover story for this was a traffic study. That's what they had said at the time, and that's what Christie said he believed. He thought when there was noise about this traffic jam going on, oh, it's just the traffic study. That's all they're doing, but it was a fraud. It was not a traffic study at all.
I remember when I first heard about it, maybe from some of your reporting, I just thought, oh, come on. You know,
yeah, it sounds preposterous.
It sounds completely preposterous. And then as more information came out, and then as you described, you think, who is affected when there's a traffic jam of that magnitude? Mm-hmm. And the question about this traffic study, was there a traffic study going on? Do we even know that?
A week or two before the lanes were closed, Wildstein started getting traffic data from the engineers at the Port Authority. So he had some – there are some documents that – depending on how you interpret it, could be viewed as a traffic study. But this is not how you do traffic studies. I mean, it takes months of planning, and everybody in the agency is aware of it, and there's warning to via the media. And there were bureaucrats of the Port Authority that were telling Wildstein, this is going to be a disaster. We need to tell we got to tell the public. We need to tell our host community of Fort Lee. You can't just, you know, do this major shift in lanes and not let anybody know. Hmm. And he said, there'll be radio silence. Don't tell anybody. And they didn't. And it was a disaster. The cops found out a couple of days before that they had to go out there and move the lanes. And there were cops working overtime to deal with the excessive traffic. I mean, there was no this was, for any all intents and purposes, does not appear to have been a real traffic study.
You interviewed Chris Christie about this traffic study, the Bridgegate. Did you glean any? Did he tell you anything you didn't know?
No, he didn't say much at all. In fact, the interview kind of went off the rails.
He wanted to throw you out of the room.
Yeah, using some colorful language, he threatened to throw me out of the room because I knew in advance that he was unlikely to say anything about Bridgegate, but I also thought this was the last opportunity any reporter would have to get into the weeds with him about it. And I was not only – my questions were not only just about the traffic jam, but also about what happened in the aftermath. There was a lot of noise in the governor's office that something shady had happened here, and there were people telling him that they thought – certain people might have known something and might have known more. And he had several federal prosecutors working for him, and he's a former federal prosecutor himself.
Right.
So I had questions about why they didn't figure it out, why whether they were hoping this would just blow over, whether if he didn't know about it, why he wasn't more curious. And that these are questions he did not want to ask in the interview sort of it went off. Yeah, it didn't
off the rails.
Yeah, it went off the rails.
Matt Katz is our guest, and we're talking about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, the subject of Matt's brand new book called American Governor Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I'm going to pick through some of the comments here. Someone wants to know, does Chris Christie ever talk about being overweight? How much is that an issue for him, do you think?
I think it's a major issue. I think it's an issue that is of importance to my story about him because it makes him so American. It makes him so human. But he's had a very complicated relationship with it. So publicly, in the way he's publicly dealt with it, he almost cried when Oprah asked him about it. And he had this extraordinary interview with Oprah where Oprah said she had never had such a deep interview with a man about weight before. And this is a woman who's obviously lived her whole life dealing with weight issues. And then he got lap band surgery in order to, you know, deal with the issue and had to do a long press conference to explain it because it was secret lap band surgery. And then it was revealed by the New York Post. He's been made fun of extensively about it, both politically. John Corzine ran a campaign ad when the incumbent governor in 2009, where he showed Christie getting out of his car and zoomed in on his jiggling belly. And Christie went after Corzine about that, and it was a big embarrassment for Corzine. It worked out politically well for Christie. But he's also been made fun of it by comedians at like the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And he's laughed heartily and said, hey, you know, if they're talking about me, it's good. He's eaten a donut with David Letterman. So he's poked fun at himself. He's used it to go after opponents if they use it against him. And he's also been forced to confront it publicly when, you know, this lap band surgery. It is obviously unusual for there to be a politician this large who's on the national stage. But I will say, interestingly enough, he has lost weight since the lap band surgery, and it hasn't come up at all. In this presidential race, there was a flyer that Jeb Bush put out this week in New Hampshire, where it might have been his super PAC, but whatever, you know.
Hard to tell sometimes.
Exactly right. And it referenced Christie's massive Medicaid expansion and had a picture of him with Obama and an unflattering picture of him with Obama. And massive was written in big letters. And that reminded some of us reporters of when Corzine used his weight against him. And at the time, Christie had said, hey, man, just man up and say I'm fat.
He talks a lot about his mother. I know there are certain stories that he tells about his mother. He seems to reference his wife a lot, Mary Pat. And at least as an outsider, she seems like she's with him on a number of these events that he's been doing, running for president. You write about, and others have written about, the fact that he grew up in a family that sounded like his parents fought a lot. There were problems, maybe abuse, I'm not sure, alcoholism, but certainly a lot of family dysfunction there. How much do you think that has affected his personality? It seems like his mother has been or was, you know, such a powerful presence in his life.
Yes, for sure. There was no physical abuse in his house, but his mother was abused by her first husband and got divorced. His grandmother also got divorced, and he was the closest to both women. I mean, he's really identified in terms of emotionally with women in his growing up more than men, which is very interesting. And in his own household with his dad, there was a lot of fighting between the parents, and he acted as something of a peacemaker. And later on, he talks about how he adopted his mother's sort of combative style. And to this day, he says when he fights with his wife, which he says he does, he won't do it in front of the children. So they go to her walk-in closet. He also told me that he went to marriage counseling when he highly recommends it to his friends. It was an interesting emotional side to the governor that I hadn't necessarily expected.
Well, and I mean, that's a nice big closet. I'm trying to imagine talking to my husband in my closet.
Oh, it's a big closet, I'm sure.
It's a very big closet. There would not be a lot of room in there.
They have quite the McMansion, yes.
Let me see some other comments here. Actually, let me play another clip. And we, you know, there are many that we could have used. And this goes back to the second anniversary of Hurricane Sandy. And this is Governor Chris Christie. He's yelling at a heckler in the crowd. And we were talking about how he, I guess, has used some of these incidents as a way to promote himself on the national stage. Let's give it a listen.
Somebody like you who doesn't know a damn thing about what you're talking about, except to stand up and show off when the cameras are here. I've been here when the cameras aren't here, buddy, and done the work. So listen, you want to have the conversation later? I'm happy to have it, buddy. But until that time, sit down and shut up.
One of his famous sit down and shut up, I guess his famous sit down and shut up comment. Is that the Chris Christie we should think about when we see him running for president?
That's one of them. He likes to say he has many clubs in the bag, and I believe he is more than that. But flying off the handle at a constituent, calling a former Navy SEAL an idiot.
And that's who that was, right?
That was not a Navy SEAL. That was somebody who had volunteered with Sandy victims to helping them rebuild and was upset with the governor for not doing enough. And he was heckling. He was holding up a sign in the middle of a Christie event, and he wouldn't sit down and shut up. And instead of letting the police take care of it and you know, letting the guy say what he had to say and moving on, he got angry and he lost his temper. There's no question. I was standing there. I saw the look in his eyes. He totally lost his temper. But I think he has more self-control than maybe some of us give him credit for. And I believe he does have more clubs in the bag, meaning he can take a different tact when dealing with opponents. And behind closed doors, he can be extremely charming, and he can twist arms in a gentle way when necessary. And he is not just a hothead. But that is certainly part of it, and that is certainly part of what America could expect if they want to elect him president.
You spend some time sort of wrestling with this idea whether he has an anger management problem. I realize you're not a psychologist or anything like that, but you come to a different kind of conclusion. And it isn't about the anger. It's about something else.
Emotion. I think he's a deeply emotional person. I think he feels deeply. I was with him when he visited victims in the hours after Sandy hit, and the way he hugged these people, the way he kissed them, the way he told them everything was going to be okay and that he was going to take care of it and that they had their family and their loved ones and that all that, that's all that mattered. The way he talked to children then, it was really impactful on these people. I mean, it really meant a lot, and they would cry together. He cried after Bridgegate. I think he has a wide range of emotions, but one of them is to, you know, be angry. And I've been on the receiving end of that myself.
Has he read your book yet? Do you know?
I don't know, although I heard from an inside source that a woman in Iowa the other day picked up the book at Walmart and brought it over to a town hall meeting and asked him to sign it, and he actually signed it. But I don't know if he read it. I hope that he thinks I was fair, although I'm sure there are sections of it, particularly the Bridgegate section, that he might rather skip.
Well, we have to end our conversation. Matt Katz, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times once again.
Thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome, and congratulations on the book as well.
I appreciate that.
The book is called American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. And Matt is going to be at Barnes & Noble on Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia tonight at 7 o'clock. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.